Christ, the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now in episode number 681. My name is Camden Busey, and it's time for Voss Group. And of course, if it's time for that, we have with us our fellow of biblical and systematic theology, Dr. Lane Tipton. Welcome back, Lane. It's good to speak with you today.
Camden, as always, it's a delight to be here.
Yes, it's been a while since we've had a Voss group that's just a normal sequenced one, not an excursus, not talking about Grace and Glory, which are also important episodes and conversations. But today, if, by my count, we're on episode number 67. And
oh, wow.
We're walking through, I mean, in the normal series, walking through biblical theology, Old and New Testaments, and turning to page 245, all the way through 250, we hope, to speak about holiness, God's holiness, particularly during this period of the content of the prophetic revelation. And there are many things that Voss is dealing with as he counteracts liberal theology and critical theology, and to speak of God's holiness in distinction from pagan notions and other conceptions that might be brought to the table. So that's our subject matter today. Before we get into that, got a few things just to remind people of, not to take too much time, but we've got a whole host of resources available online. I do want to point people to reformedforum.org, particularly our courses tab at the top of the page toward the header of the website. And if you go in there, you can find all the courses we have available. We have, at the time of this recording, four that have been published. We have a fifth one that has been completely recorded, and it's in the process of being edited and formatted for the online learning system. And that's a course on Van Til's Trinitarian Theology. We're also editing a manuscript Lane has written on the subject, in addition to companion books for several of our courses. One is Foundations of Covenant Theology. Another, it's taking a little longer, is the one on Introduction to Covenant Theology. So there's a lot in the works. Many books here in various forms of completion at Reformed Forum by several different authors. And it's an exciting time. We encourage you to check it out online, to subscribe to the email newsletter, which you'll find in the footer of the page, and certainly sign up for some of the courses and let us know what you think. And as new courses come out, subscribe and sign up for those. They're free. And participate. We're seeking here to present every person mature in Christ, and we found that there's a great hunger and a desire for people around the world to learn these things, which is encouraging. And we hear from people all the time who are following on Voss Group and reading these books, who are reading Van Til and in coordination with our Van Til group, and reading and learning all sorts of interesting things relative to the online courses we have. People from, I think, the by recent count, 55 different countries. So it's exciting. It's encouraging.
It's exciting.
And we're looking forward to doing more this year. If you'd like to support our efforts, obviously, please pray for us, encourage us, you know, write in through the email. But you can also donate at reformedforum.org, a very simple way and an easy form. Even a few dollars helps a lot as it adds up. We have quite a number of donors who donate $5 or $10, and that is not at all insignificant. It helps us to cover our costs, to pay for editing, translations, all sorts of important things that go directly to the work, the program work, so to speak, here at Reform Forum. And I'm excited, Lane. I'm looking forward to the things we have in store here in 2021. But let's take our time and open up to page 245 here. Certainly an exciting section as we are speaking about the holiness of God, but it's the holiness of God here is certainly a topic that gets taken in a bunch of different directions. Voss starts off speaking about Kodesh, the Hebrew word and the root. What's he getting at when he starts looking at the actual word and a little bit of etymology?
Well, Camden, it's interesting that you and I were talking about this right before we started. It's really refreshing, I think, to look at the biblical theological treatment of the attributes of God. As you've commented before, there are many times that we've talked about attributes moving up to this specific, concrete, sustained focus. But one thing to just keep in mind as we start looking at holiness here is that there's not going to be a disjunctive relationship between a biblical theological understanding of God's attributes and a systematic theological understanding of God's attributes. If you take Voss's Reformed Dogmatics and take his biblical theology, you'll see that the attributes aren't different. And the emphasis here on holiness, what you get here as he considers Kodesh and the meaning of holiness at this particular juncture, what you get here that you don't get in the systematic theology is a treatment of how the holiness of God interfaces explicitly with the themes of redemptive history, especially in the prophetic epoch. And what Voss is doing for those, you know, there's a broad range of listeners, some who know Hebrew, some who don't know Hebrew. And when
some
Voss
who used
talks
to know
about,
Hebrew.
And what's that?
Some who used to know Hebrew.
Yeah, and those who have known Hebrew and have not been keeping up with even reading maybe Genesis 3 or 15 or 22, which is a good way to keep up with it, by the way. There Voss talks about the radicals, and all he's getting at is that each consonant of a root or a stem is called a radical. And Voss is talking about the conjunction of radicals that when you're thinking etymologically, what does Kodesh mean? What does holiness connote? And the first is to take the radicals of a root, kadash, to shine, from which is formed the adjective for new. And it would render the sense of a new thing shining forth. And that would get to the active sense of holiness pretty well. But Voss says that's not the best way to do it. He says you could take the derivation from a root group having for its first radicals the combination of kof, aleph, and dalet. And what inheres in the idea of that is a cutting or a separation. And Voss says that's the better root conception of holiness, because it helps us recognize holiness is all about the fundamental ontological separation of God from the creature. Voss uses terms like the divine aloofness or the divine majesty. And the idea, before it's an ethical idea, which Voss talks about later in this chapter, it's first and foremost, it brings into view the idea of God in his being, set apart in his majesty above all that is created, distinct from it. And so this is, once again, I know this is a leitmotif that we keep seeing, but it's there in Reformed biblical and Reformed systematic theology, is that it's a wonderful way to render the creator-creature distinction. And the holiness of God is going to bring into view his intrinsic separation from and exaltation over all that is made. And so it's really, I think if you polled people, maybe not from the Voss group, but outside of our Voss group, or maybe just general evangelical census, what do you think of when you think of holiness? Typically, I think the movement would be to talk about ethical purity. But Voss is saying that ethical purity is going to flow from this notion of separation, exaltation, and divine majesty. And so he makes a comment that it's easier to subsume all that pertains to the idea of holiness under the concept of separation, majestic exaltation above creatures. From that, Voss says, flows the accompanying or sister conception of ethical purity. And so I really think he's off to a really helpful way of framing this, Camden, so that we're not first thinking about an ethical consideration. We're first thinking about something ontological, metaphysical, or theological.
Sure, and his understanding of ethical is always in relation to God, which is in distinction from what he makes it on page 250 from moral goodness. Mm-hmm. He wants to distinguish between moral goodness and ethical goodness, and he wants us to consider things in light of ethical goodness, but that definition of ethical goodness is always a relational one. And the liberal theologians would certainly want to either despiritualize or demythologize the scriptures so that, you know, God could be a moral idea. So liberals have no problem with moral theology, but they have a problem with ethical theology understood in Voss's sense. My biggest takeaway from these six pages is clearly the entrance. As Voss enters into the text, he speaks about holiness as something better considered and approached negatively. But then he contrasts pagan notions of holiness with that found in the biblical prophets in special revelation. The basic idea for me, at least, was just this notion that holiness always and must be God-centered, that it begins with the Lord, it begins with his transcendence, and then it radiates outward to creation as he is revealed. And that's how we must consider holiness whenever it's applied to creation, that whether it's holiness as an adjective or an attribute or descriptor is applied to man who's made in God's image, or it's applied to places, to consecrated objects, even to the day, such as the Sabbath, it's always beginning with the Lord and then bringing into that conception the things or the person's relationship to the Lord. That's a tremendous thesis point, and I think really useful as Voss is distinguishing holiness here, biblically understood from all other conceptions.
It is, and he says what that moves us to do then, Camden, as Voss starts getting into it on page 245 and moving forward, he says, how then are we to understand more concretely the concept of holiness that applies first to God, and then in a derivative way applies to places or image bearers or features of the creation? And he says, with that thesis in view, I really like the way you frame it, Camden, that is a kind of global summary of everything that Voss is after here. He says that when you're trying to find out whether or not it's better to think of holiness as a new shining forth of some sense, or right. A separation and majestic exaltation. He says that, and this is especially there on page 245 and following, he says that in the next place, he says that the opposite of kadosh is kol, to loose, to be loose, to be open or accessible. And a few of the references he gives, 1 Samuel 21:5, Ezekiel 42:20, and Amos 2:7, give you the idea of what holiness means in the sense of being separated, cut off, or non-trespassable. And I think the best of the three he gives, and maybe you could read it and we could just think about it for a second, is Exodus 42:20. When you're thinking about the term holiness, Exodus 42:20 gives you a really lucid conception with the temple as a good example. Could we read that, Camden? Do you think that'd be good?
Yeah, we're speaking of Ezekiel, correct?
Yeah, I think the 42:20 text is probably more useful than 1 Samuel and Amos 2. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Ezekiel, not Exodus. So that's, he measured it on the four sides. It had a wall around it, 500 cubits long and 500 cubits broad, to make a separation between the holy and the common.
Yeah, and there, Voss is saying, his point is that the separation between the holy and the common helps you recognize that it's not necessarily a new light shining forth per se, but a distinguishing of something that is sacred, devoted to the Lord, filled with his glory and presence in a unique way, a covenantal way, that other things are not. So it's that classic distinction there between the holy and the common. Mm-hmm. And Voss says there's also then, in light of that, a certain synonymy that can be observed between the idea of holiness and that which is connected with the root charam, the hifil of the latter meaning, according to Voss, to devote. And Klein develops, I think, very usefully. This would be a wonderful episode in itself, Canon, the notion of Karam warfare, in which Israel's holiness and devotion to the Lord entails cutting off and rendering permanently inaccessible the unholy enemies of God, cutting them off from the holy realm, bringing judgment upon them, so that the idea of being devoted to God flows from being set apart to God as holy. And so I think this is really useful, and this opens up a venue, or a vista rather, to see some of the connections between Voss and Klein. Holiness and devotion can become almost synonymous. And that's really brought into view in Karam warfare, where those who are holy to the Lord, those who inhabit the dwelling place of his glory, whether it be the land generally or the temple more specifically, or the tabernacle in the mobile form, they're devoted to the Lord in such a way that they preview the final separation of the righteous and the unrighteous, the holy and the profane. And so Voss is saying, when we think about holiness, whether we're thinking about the Creator or his relation to the creature, the idea of separation, majestic separation between the Creator and the creature, and an ethical separation of the people of God from those who are not dwelling in the holy realm, separation is going to be a kind of critical and central notion that governs what we say about holiness. And so it can really start to not only give us a clear conception of who God is, but it can also help us think about who God is in relation to creation in unique ways.
Yeah, and it must be that way, especially as he starts speaking about holiness even before he gets to special revelation, as he's bringing in conceptions of the pagan gods at the time. And that's useful too. And he just, you know, gently throughout the pages reminds us that we always must have a God-centered conception of holiness. It does have to do with separation from the common, from the world, etc. But if you don't start at some point with the conception of who God is in himself, then you end up, when you start to define holiness, you end up begging the question.
Yeah.
Because then you say, well, what is you ask, what is holiness? And you say it has to do with connection to or association with or devotion to God. But you haven't asked the question, or at least answered the question of, what is this God like? And so
Absolutely. It
always has to be God-centered, and in that regard, revelation-centered, and particularly here, special revelation-centered, whereas God tells us what he's like. And then our notion of holiness can conform to that.
Yeah. And on page 246, Voss begins to talk about how the idea, bottom of 245, top of 246, how the idea of cutting off, or the notion of separation, came to be applied to the deity, to God himself, in a conceptual way. And this is really interesting, Kim, and I think this is of great practical value to our listeners. The original sense, Voss says, is a negative and practical sense that describes a rule of behavior when seeking to relate to God. And so holiness, Voss is saying, teaches not first and foremost what God is, but what is not to be done in relation to him. Put differently, holiness is a deeply religious concept. One way of putting it, it's a regulative conception for the way that we ought to relate to a God who is holy. And on page 246, about halfway down, he says that unapproachability, and this is interesting, unapproachability would best express that idea. So that God's majestic exaltation above the creature means that the creature does not have some intrinsic right to approach God, but God is inherently unapproachable given his majestic exaltation above the creature. Something in that ballpark is what Voss is saying, that just the idea of holiness involves. And then this gets intensified, developed, enriched, and filled out in profound ways in the history of special revelation.
Mm-hmm. So you quote here in some notes that the divine is divine, and God insists upon having this distinction between itself and the creature recognized. Why is this so significant? How does this start to govern what Voss is saying? God is wholly other. He's transcendent, yet he relates to the creature, but putting those two together is of utmost importance.
Yeah, I mean, this way of putting it, I think, is a really useful way, that the divine is divine, and that distinction between what is divine and not divine, that remains in place at every point as God reveals himself to the creature. And so we've said it, I don't want to repeat it exactly the way we've said it in the past, but let's put it this way. What Voss means, the divine is divine, God insists upon having this distinction between himself and the creature recognized. While Voss hasn't moved directly into the history of special revelation yet, this is an axiom that special revelation is going to maintain at every point. And it's something like this. God, when he relates to the creature, doesn't domesticate his holiness. He doesn't ameliorate that holiness by willing some softer, more gentle, more relatable qualities in order to relate to the creature. He doesn't domesticate himself by changing himself, taking mutable qualities to himself. The majesty of God's absolute holiness means that he remains holy and exalted above the creature at every point that he relates to the creature. And this may be, I don't want to get ahead, but this may be the reason why Isaiah is just so undone when he encounters God's holiness in the heaven temple in Isaiah 6, because he's not interacting with a domesticated God who has softened or modified that majestic holiness and distinctness from the creature. It is precisely his distinctness and majestic exaltation above Isaiah that literally undoes him. And so I think Voss is wanting to say something along these lines, that God remains absolute and holy, set apart from and infinitely exalted above the creature, precisely in his relation to the creature. And one point that's just worth mentioning, this is not a systematic theological conception. This is a biblical theological conception of God in relation to the creature. So it's not as though there's a certain kind of God presented in the systematics approach, a certain kind of God presented in the biblical theological approach.
Right.
For Voss, it's the same God, the same attributes viewed in different relations. And this one, I think, is very, very useful. And it drives us, Camden, I think the thing that this does, it drives us to worship.
Oh, it ought to.
You know, yeah.
Well, you know, and this fights against, in many respects, that Marcionite notion that we have a different type of God in the Old Testament. In fact, we have a different God, according to his conception, the God of wrath and anger and justice, and then a God of love, compassion, etc., in the New Testament. But here in Voss's conception, it they sweetly comply. They hold together. We don't have different gods, and neither do we have a God who is changing. Nevertheless, the relation between God and creation can change because that which is occurring in creation is changing. And so we can have both at the same time without compromising the Lord or somehow requiring him to change himself or adopt or assume new properties. God always can be both a God of goodness and grace as well as a God of righteousness and wrath, because all of those descriptors or attributes are expressions of his eternal and immutable being.
Yeah, and right on that point, Camden, that's so well said, by the way. Right on that point, Voss reminds us then that holiness here, and this is hard to express, but holiness is not simply an attribute thought of in isolation, but holiness is something that he says is, quote, I believe this is over on page 246, we're still moving toward 247, is coextensive and applicable to everything that characterizes God. And that means it characterizes God in himself, it characterizes God in his revelation, and in that sense, if you're thinking about the idea of God's holiness in relation to his creation, you can never become, to use Voss's language, you can never attain vulgar familiarity with God, like you've contained him or exhausted him or understood his fulness. This is something I think is really important for us to remember, and it suffuses the holiness of God, suffuses the relation between the creator and the creature with this sense of mystery and reverence and awe, the only proper response of which is worship, whether angel or sinner redeemed, a worship that grows out of an overwhelming awe of that character that is revealed in a holy God, as Voss is conceiving it.
Sure.
Very, very, very edifying to reflect on.
And that's also why I think Voss points out the notion and theme of majesty in many different passages, correct? I mean, when we think of God as holy, other, and exalted, that's majestic. And we see that in Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah is very nearly undone and beside himself because he beholds the Lord in his holiness, but also in his majesty seated on the throne. What are some other passages that Voss refers to describe this majestic holiness of Yahweh?
Camden, over on page 247, and I'm going to leave it to you to how many of these you think would be useful to read. but he lists a number. 1 Samuel 2:2, Hosea 11:9, Isaiah 57:15, which we've looked at and can be opened up even more from this vantage point. Habakkuk 1:12, Exodus 15:1 through 2. And as you read them, if you think maybe we could just kind of read them seriatim and then make a few comments on them, I think what you start to see is that there is this correlation between God's holiness and God being a rock, and there's a correlation between God's holiness and his almighty power, so that the holiness of God, as he reveals himself, his exaltation above the creature, entails that he is unchanging in his almighty power toward us. And it is of the deepest conceivable comfort to know that the God who is infinitely exalted above us, infinitely distinguished from us in terms of his being and attributes and power and glory, that power, and not another power, that power is what is revealed. That power is what redeems. That power is what preserves and delivers us. That power is what judges sin. And so I just can't think of a more comforting doctrine for the saints than to know that God's holiness is coincident with and expressive of his absolute power. Both are immutable, unchangeable in their expression toward us. So perhaps could we read just maybe the 1 Samuel 2 through about, sure, the Habakkuk 1:12?
Yeah.
And then
1 Samuel 2:2, there is none holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you. There is no rock like our God. Then Hosea 11:9, I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. We'll pause there if there's any comments.
Yeah, just a brief one Camden, feel free to expand here. That singular holiness in 1 Samuel 2:2, and the rock-like character of God. That's where I think we get a lot of the religious value of this doctrine. To speak as practically as I know how, if you worship the God who is holy, who is encircled by the seraphim, who dwells in heaven and made the heavens and the earth and all that is in them, one thing that's certain is that his holiness makes him for his people a rock. And all that image is designed to invoke or evoke in biblical categories is something solid and immovable and steady and intrinsically reliable, something that's not going to change. So it's a deeply, the holiness of God, very similar to what we said earlier about immutability from Malachi 3:6, it is a deeply religious doctrine that brings the profoundest of comfort for the people of God. The conjunction between rock and holy, God remains precisely who he is, the immutable and holy rock in his covenantal revelation for his people. No greater. It's just hard to think of something more comforting than that.
Oh, sure. Isaiah 57:15, for thus says the one who is high and lifted up, who inherits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place, and also with him who is of a contrite and lowly spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite. That distinction's interesting to me, because if we think of the opposite of the lowly and the contrite, the high and lifted up would be for us to put ourselves into God's place, which would be a compromise or an attempt to compromise his majesty.
Amen. In fact, it would be the essence of either Satan's fall from heaven, wanting the majesty, wanting the glory, wanting the worship, or it would be the essence of the fall, where Eve and then by extension Adam as our federal head put himself in the place of God, took those prerogatives to himself, and the consequence, the irony is the consequence, everyone who exalts himself will be brought low, but right. He who is humbled before the Lord will be exalted. Yeah.
Yep. How about Habakkuk? We'll read that one. 1:12. Yeah. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. Another mention of rock here.
Yeah, and I'll just note this, because we've looked at it before. This is, in one sense, a kind of companion text to the Malachi 3:6 text. I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore, you sons of Jacob shall not be consumed. Here, are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. The point being that it's this unchanging, exalted, sovereign God who preserves life and extends assurance and gives an infallible hope for the past, the present, and the future, but with an eye, I think, here especially on the future. If you took one other text, Exodus 15:1-2, which Voss invokes, especially as God's power is expressed in the Exodus, you can start to correlate the holiness of God with his almighty power to save. And the beautiful conjunction of those two is that if he is the same and rock-like in the former, his holiness, then he is the same and rock-like in the latter, his being mighty to save. And so trying to get this into our minds, it's a theme that comes out, especially now in the prophets and as we're dealing with the attributes of God. We don't want a God who fluctuates and varies and is involved in the give and take and submerged in the vicissitudes of time and change. We don't want the God of Socinianism or the God of modernism. Right. We want the God of the scriptures, the God of the creeds and the confessions, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the prophets. And why? Not simply because it's orthodox to believe and confess, but because this God alone gives us hope and confidence in the face of manifold trials and suffering and the forces of evil that are gathered around us. It's this God in Christ whom we worship and who protects and defends us from his and our enemies. It's as practical as it gets.
Yeah, and that's indicated here in the subjective response of the people in Scripture. Just what you characterize right there is certainly something on display. We see in 1 Samuel, then the men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God, and to whom shall he go up away from us?" Or as we mentioned several times already, Isaiah 6, Isaiah's response to the not just revelation, but he's transported in a sense to the highest heavens to see the Lord. That's an appropriate response of a faithful creature in the face of a holy and righteous God.
Yeah, it is. And Camden, we've talked about Isaiah 6 so often, but please note this. We've done it because Voss keeps circling back to it. Right. The reason we do it is that we're following Voss. And I think to put this, I try to find new ways to put it. Isaiah 6 is, let me relate it to Moses in Exodus 24. I've probably done this before. We have, Camden. But in Exodus 24, you get the virtual high point of the Mosaic covenant. What is it? Moses is brought up to the earthly mountain, enveloped by the glory cloud, and has fellowship with God for 40 days and 40 nights. It's the high point of the Mosaic covenant. What happens with Isaiah is he is lifted or given prophetic vision into not the earthly mountain of God's glory, but what in Hebrews 12 is going to be called Heavenly Mount Zion, or what in Hebrews 8:5 is going to be called the Heavenly Temple. And in the thing, and this moves us in the direction of a theme that Voss begins to develop on page 248 on holiness, moral purity, and the holy theocratic dwelling of God. What happens is that when Isaiah sees that fullness of God's holiness, the radiance and splendor of the divine majesty seated on the throne in the heaven temple, surrounded by the living seraphim, worshiping him constantly and ascribing glory to his name, what happens is Isaiah comes into contact not just with a God who has moral purity, but a God whose being and character is such that nothing impure can remain in that gaze in that proximity to the presence of God. And it begins, you could say this, it begins the tremors of hell, as it were, as he condemns himself. He feels the weight of God's holiness in the form of wrath that is ready to break out against him, as it were, and he covers his mouth. He condemns himself. The condemnation he's going to bring upon Israel, he announces upon himself. But then God, in his grace, typifying the movement that's going to come from the one seated in heaven to come down, to make atonement and to enter back into the presence of God, returning Isaiah into his presence, the angel comes forth with the coal, sin is atoned for, and he stands. But the point here is that it's the in the prophetic era, it's the first clear, explicit vision of the archetypal heaven temple that has one primary purpose: to be the theater of that holiness that evokes never-ending worship. And it really starts to raise the question, Camden, and Voss starts to deal with this on page 248. What are, or how should we think about the relationship between what Voss calls God's majesty holiness and the places where his glory or his holiness dwell? And I got that just, I think you did too, Camden. I can just say that when I was reading through this material, my heart was really starting to burn within me. There's some beautiful material on page 248.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's a joy to read this and then kind of to see some of the intellectual and more importantly, the biblical and scriptural backgrounds to Meredith Klein. We know they're not identical, but Klein is self-consciously developing the theology and insights of Gerhardus Voss as well as Cornelius Van Til through his writings and adding much of his own brilliance to those things. But just to see how congruent these are with some of our other topics and things we've been developing, and we're deep in it now because you of course have taught our online course Foundations of Covenant Theology, and now we're getting really close to sending that final, you know, typeset manuscript off to the printer, I'm hoping in a couple of weeks. And so it's been on our minds as we've been looking at that movement from the earthly to the heavenly and the plan and purpose that God has instituted in the very structure of creation to bring his covenant people from ultimately from one degree of glory to another, but from the earthly to the heavenly to an even higher, more glorious, consummate eschatological life with his people. You know, that's true even of not just spaces, but I love this. I'm jumping ahead. I might be jumping ahead a little too far, but to speak of the Sabbath and the day just in relation to God, he writes on 250, thus God hallowed the Sabbath. Hallowed the Sabbath. Sorry, that's my mispronunciation. You might get misunderstood. He didn't hollow out the Sabbath, but thus God hallowed the Sabbath, not because it inherently possessed a peculiar character to which magic and superstition could attach themselves, but because it was his will that the day should bear a peculiar significance, reminding of and binding it to the service of God. And to extend that out, to think of the eternal Sabbath, and to think of that type of life and that we ultimately are to have in the new heavens and the new earth, it all draws it together in a wonderful biblical theological way. That God's character is on display already. It was in the Garden of Eden. It still is, even in this common era of redemption, in the midst of common grace. But even when the Lord comes and makes a final separation, sheep and goats, and brings final judgment, his holiness and his glory will be evident through all, as we have a merger and really a kind of eschatological transformation of the earthly and translation, not just in a language sense, but in, you know, from one form to another, the translation of the earthly up into the heavenly. That'll be a glorious day.
Oh, it will be. And no, I don't think you're jumping the gun at all, Canon. I think you're kind of giving a Sabbath preview of a principle. And that principle is on the last full paragraph of page 248, where he says this: side by side with holiness in God himself, holiness is predicated of certain things that are more or less closely related to him. Full stop. We need to stop and think about that for a second. What is he after? Here's the principle. The principle is that God's majesty holiness lays the groundwork, the theological foundation, for the conception of a holy realm where God's presence is uniquely and intimately made known. And as his presence is made known in that realm, it is hallowed, it is set apart as holy to the Lord, and devoted fundamentally to the worship of the Lord. So here's the principle, the way Voss is putting it as he develops it. Things or places or people are not holy in themselves. We're thinking especially about realms that God creates right here. Places are not holy in themselves, but acquire a holy character given God's dwelling in them, either in the new relation of creation in the covenant of works, or in the redemptive relation of salvation in the covenant of grace. And so, in to use a supreme example, a primal example here, Voss says, quote, there on that just a couple lines down, thus, in the new relation of creation, quote, heaven is called holy. Now, what does that mean? It means this, and this is where I think Klein is so useful in expounding Voss, that Klein in Images of the Spirit, and especially God, Heaven, and Armageddon, when he develops his theology of what's called indoxation, he is developing Voss's concept here. What is that? Well, in Klein's theology of indoxation, heaven is created in the absolute beginning as a royal temple realm, a holy dwelling place. God's throne is there, Isaiah 66:1, to use a prophet example. So Genesis 1:1, Nehemiah 9:6, Isaiah 6:1 through 7, construe that realm as a temple dwelling, a holy realm, where the angels are present to worship God. But what makes that place holy, according to Klein and Voss, this is just a fine-tuning of Voss, is that the spirit of holiness dwells uniquely in avian form in that holy temple realm, Genesis 1:2 and following. So heaven is holy, not in itself, but it is holy because it is the unique dwelling place of the Spirit who fills it with the personal glory of the triune God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So it's not that heaven is holy and therefore God dwells there. It's rather that God dwells there, fills it with this glory of the Spirit, and therefore heaven is holy. And by holy, Voss has in view something uniquely set apart as a realm devoted entirely to worship. Nehemiah 9:6, the angels populate that realm and worship you. Isaiah 6 makes it explicit. Revelation 4 makes it explicit. The seraphim encircle God and constantly worship him as something that is both descriptive and prescriptive. It describes what heaven's like. It prescribes what heaven is for. And Eden, then, as a lower register replica of heaven is holy. The tabernacle, as a lower register replica of heaven is holy. The temple, lower register replica of heaven is holy. The land of Canaan is holy in a sense. And so Voss says this, if Jehovah is unapproachably majestic, then it becomes important to draw a circle of holiness around him, which shall bar out the profane. And that circle of holiness drawn around him is his dwelling place in heaven. And then those unique, special theocratic dwelling places on earth that are replicas of heaven. And then Camden, as you say, when the new heavens and new earth come, and there is a translation of the earthly things into the heavenly things, and God's glory is made known in all of his fullness, there is a transforming of the new heavens and new earth into the royal dwelling place of God, so that all mediates that presence for the purpose of worship. And so for both Voss and Klein, but especially right here, Voss, the holiness of God properly understood is the ground for this wonderful theology of God dwelling uniquely, covenantally in a place, setting it apart for worship, so that elect angels and the church might glorify and worship him forever. It's just a beautiful conception. And notice, it's the marriage of what? It's the marriage of classical Reformed theology proper and classical Reformed biblical theology, of which Voss is a pioneer, both of these enriching our theology of the covenant. It's astonishing.
Right. No, which makes the Reformed tradition, particularly the federal tradition, you know, as the Reformed have developed covenant theology, it makes our tradition then uniquely capable and suitable to develop these basic themes in Scripture. We see it's not just some sort of academic peculiarity or idiosyncrasy, but an organic development of these thoughts that are fundamentally and most basically Catholic in the sense, small c Catholic, applicable to the whole church. The whole church ought to be covenantally, you know, understood and developing these thoughts along these lines.
Absolutely. And Camden, just to piggyback on one of your points from page 250, when he's talking about the Sabbath, think of God creating the lower register and then entering into a Sabbath rest where heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. He's resting on his heaven throne, as it were. Genesis 2:2, Isaiah 66:1. Voss makes this point that the holiness of things, the holiness of realms, is not due to anything in them, but the beautiful quote on page 250, but that their holiness, quote, is due only to a free sanctifying act of God. And what is that act? In Klein's language, it's indoxation. It is the divine presence coming to rest in a unique and covenantal way in a holy realm devoted to the worship of God. And isn't that precisely what Sabbath rest is? It is for God resting from all of his labors for what purpose? Labors of creation for what purpose? That elect angels and the church might enter that rest, which Gaffin so helpfully, in Pressing Toward the Mark essay, Sabbath Rest Awaits People of God, he calls it a resting realm. I love that. That the church is brought into that resting realm where her worship is perfected. This goes, and on what does that worship rest? It rests in recognizing the glory of the Holy One of Israel in the person and work and kingdom of a crucified and resurrected Christ. That's where the Sabbath theme takes you. So Hebrews 4:9-11 moves us directly into what Voss is talking about in the biblical theology. So really, I mean, as much as we talk about systematic theology and theology proper, we've been doing it because we focused on the attributes of God. The beauty of the biblical theology is that he reminds us that quote-unquote systematic theological doctrine of God is in service of biblical theology and in the nature of the God who reveals himself in the history of special revelation. And so when we're contemplating him, we're not contemplating him according to an abstract method, but according to his concrete self-revelation in the Scriptures. And this is the result of it, what Voss is giving us. And so, you know, I hope our listeners can sense this, Camden, and I think it's starting to come through. Voss is so helpful in showing us the slow, organic unfolding of the glory of God in the holy realm of heaven and the way the movement in redemptive history is driving us in that direction. All of this is moving us to the one who comes down out of heaven, makes atonement for sin, returning us to God in his death, and then ascends into heaven and returns us to God in his life. And the biblical theology serves that. And I know we've taken a long time, we're on episode 67, but watching it in slow motion helps us capture and appreciate its beauty. It's not something to rush through just to get through. It's something to work through slowly, prayerfully, and in worship, and to savor, and makes us thankful for this kind of work, and thankful, Camden, that we can take time to do this on Voss Group.
Mm-hmm. And the next section, if this wasn't enough for you, we'll start to address righteousness on page 250, when next we pick up Voss's book, Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. Get a copy if you don't have one already. You must certainly have it, along with Voss's dogmatics and the Pauline eschatology and all those good things. So I appreciate the careful reading and walking through the text. We hope that all of you listeners and viewers are benefiting as you follow along. And if you'd like to find out more or follow up or look at or watch or listen to any of the previous episodes in the series, visit us online at reformedforum.org, where you'll find information there about all of the stuff in Relative to Voss Group and Christ the Center, but as well as all of our online courses, upcoming events, and stay in touch by subscribing to the email newsletter. And until we meet again and connect through the podcast media, I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.